The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On The Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Are you driving your car or doing laundry right now? Podcasts go best when they're bundled with another activity. Like Progressive home and auto policies, they're best when they're bundled too. Having these two policies together makes insurance easier and could help you save. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. Quote a home and car bundle today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's February of 2018, a year and a month into the presidency of Donald Trump, and we're at the point where every piece of political news is analyzed through the prism of how it will affect the midterm elections. The Democrats have openings that they haven't seen in years, as we just saw with the election of Doug Jones in Alabama. And there's talk, though certainly very speculative, of Democrats taking majorities in both houses of Congress. But a question looms over the Democratic Party. Should it run moderates and try to grab unhappy swing voters, or should they run progressive candidates on the left to re-energize the party? And the Republicans at the same time face a mirror image of that conflict as they defend their majorities in Congress. Andrew Hall is a young political scientist who studies the dynamics of elections, and he's analyzed the data on why both parties seem to have been moving toward more extreme candidates. He spoke with Amy Davidson Sorkin, a political columnist for The New Yorker, to shed some light on the upcoming midterm elections.
Andy, what's your definition of an extremist candidate or a moderate candidate?
For the purposes of my research, we use a variety of statistical techniques to try to estimate the ideological positioning of different candidates. And if you're in a Democratic primary and you're farther to the left than the other candidates, then you're more quote-unquote extreme. If you're farther to the right, you're more quote-unquote moderate, and vice versa for in a Republican primary. So it's purely a relative measure and should not be thought to convey any value judgment.
But how do you tell, like Twitter use or rhetoric or voting record?
Yeah, so we use a variety. The main thing we use is a set of techniques that look at the composition of their campaign contributions. So let's say you've never served in Congress, you're running for Congress. We don't directly know much about you yet, but we can look at what other incumbents your donors gave to. And so if you got most of your money from donors who mostly donated to, say, far-right members of Congress, we're going to infer that you're a far-right candidate.
Huh.
That's sort of the core technique we're using.
So things that we think of in terms of extremism, like calling names, you know, grandstanding, things like that, you're sort of arguing are a lot of that is noise.
I think sometimes when people use the word extreme, they're really talking about that. And I think that's important, but separate. What I'm looking at in this research should be thought of specifically as extremeness in your ideological positioning, and we can use your contributions to measure that.
There's a debate going on in the Democratic Party right now about whether they should run moderate, middle-of-the-road candidates or candidates who might, for example, be more to the left and energize their base. You've done a lot of research on that. What does your research tell you about that choice?
Yeah, I would say my research is at the individual candidate level, very precisely. When you nominate, at least in congressional races, these more extreme candidates, they tend to do very badly on average in the general election. And so if you're thinking of this from the perspective of trying to win particular seats, it's not likely to be a winning strategy in the short run. That doesn't mean, I should stress, there are broader strategical perspectives from which it may be worth that cost. And that's a different question. So if you look, for example, at the Tea Party lost a lot of general elections because of their nominations from the primaries. That doesn't mean that the movement hasn't been successful in moving the party's ideology in a particular direction. So it is the case that the more extreme candidates outperform the more moderate candidates in the primary, but it's quite modest. And it's swamped by the general election penalty to these more extreme people. The other thing I would say, thinking sort of in the aggregate about why we see a bunch of what looks like extremism if there's this penalty, is that actually voters just don't get a lot of opportunities to vote for more moderate candidates because they just don't run for office very much. And
why not?
There's probably a lot of reasons. My argument, this is the subject of my book, which is coming out, is that it's just a very difficult and unpleasant job these days. So that leads these more moderate people who might have considered running for office to choose not to.
What makes it so hard? Do you mean hard in just a practical sense or hard because it's soul-killing or...
A lot of reasons. The number one reason I would say is the difficulty of campaign finance. So if you want to run for the House today, you need to be prepared to spend most of your days dialing for dollars. And the vast majority of people, even the set of people interested in running for political office, do not enjoy that activity at all. So you layer that, I think, enormous cost, psychic and otherwise, on top of all the other costs, like giving up whatever job you currently have. And it makes it very difficult to make that choice. Then you think about, what are the benefits? Say you win. Say you incur all these costs and you win. What's your life going to look like once you're in office? Well, it turns out that seems to be a lot less attractive than it used to be. So one of, I think, the real motivations for running office used to be the chance to influence policy once you get into the legislature, to serve on important committees and be involved in drafting important legislation. And that opportunity has really dwindled in a world where now most legislation is highly centralized and run by party leadership. So I would say, from the perspective of my research, the thing we can most clearly measure and observe is that it is more extreme people who are systematically more willing to bear these costs. They're willing to spend all day dialing for dollars. They're willing to have a job where they don't have a lot of individual influence on the process because they really believe in the ideology that they're espousing. And that makes it more, they're more willing to bear the cost because of that.
Is it a bad thing to have candidates who are extreme, who really believe what they believe, who have a definable to voters set of beliefs?
That's a very hard question. That obviously goes back to how we're defining extreme, first of all. So under my definition, where I'm scaling these candidates and identifying who's relatively speaking more extreme than someone else, it seems bad only in the sense that these are not the people that general election voters seem to prefer. And so my argument in my book is, if we could get more moderate people to run for office, given how we see moderate people do in the general, voters would be happier if more moderate people ran.
Let's go back to the idea. Now you have all these people who've decided to run for office for whatever reasons, whatever the cost. At what point does that become, you know, going back to the Tea Party, what point does that become a movement that moves the party, that makes the party itself more extreme?
Yeah, I mean, I think it can pretty quickly. So I think one of the things that I think is most interesting and difficult to understand about American politics is that in a lot of ways, there really isn't a party. We have such an open system of running for office that anyone can run for office and say they're a member of whatever party they want. And that gives the party a lot less control over their own brand than most other democracies. And so when you ask or you think about how does a party come to have the positions it has, sure, they craft a national platform, which nobody reads. They certainly try to recruit particular kinds of candidates and to help them by giving them resources. But at the end of the day, they are at the mercy of who will run for office for them. And they're at the mercy of who will win office. And so the party, what the party stands for, can change pretty rapidly if the set of people who run for office change. And I think that's part of what we've seen.
Well, the Trump presidency seems to have energized a lot of people who weren't previously involved in politics. And there's a sense that in 2018, there'll be a lot of candidates running for the first time. How does that interplay with what you're talking about here?
Yeah, I think that's a very big deal. And I think it's a big deal for at least two reasons. Number one is simply having more people run for office gets you a better chance of picking very good electable candidates and therefore maps directly to electoral success. Number two, it's a huge leading indicator of electoral success. People in general are pretty good at figuring out when it's a good time to be running for office in a particular party. So when you see a party fielding more candidates than usual, it's a good sign that people on the ground think these are winnable seats.
Now, one new group of potential candidates that has emerged is women. Is there a gender aspect to this? If people look at the landscape and a lot of the discussions about women in the workplace and about Donald Trump and say, you know, this year I'm going to run for office, I'm going to run for something, how does that change all of these calculations?
I think it's going to be a huge story in 2018. I can just say, as a general election scholar, the identities of candidates matter a huge deal. Like a lot of things in politics, I sound like a broken record at this point, who runs for office is probably the most important dimension. And historically, that has been one of the biggest obstacles to getting women into office, has been that they don't run at as high a rate. And we're seeing, I think, changes in that direction.
So in a way, the real mistake is sitting around saying the Democratic Party should be doing this, should be doing that. Really, what the Democratic Party needs to be doing is figuring out who wants to run as a Democrat and how that person connects with voters, either in a district or in the country.
That's certainly my view. And I would say, you know, that is something the parties are certainly cognizant of. They do try very hard to recruit candidates. And it's a very hard thing to do because it's a really tough sell.
Because it's just not that fun to be a member of Congress these days.
No, exactly.
All right. Thank you so much.
No, it's a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Andrew Hall is an assistant professor of political science at Stanford, and he spoke to The New Yorker's Amy Davidson Sorkin.